Question: how is King Solomon like glam rock legend David Lee Roth? That's just the kind of question that has made the Stephen Dubner, Stephen Levitt franchise Freakonomics a huge intellectual hit. With two best-selling titles, Freakonomics has become a way of thinking, empowering people to shed their precious assumptions about issues, their flimsy, often moralistic and sentimental, but comfortable assumptions about why things happen, and to let the data driving what's going on speak. In their new book, Think Like a Freak, which might be called Freakonomics 3, and You Can Too, Dubner and Levitt dare us to understand that sometimes opposites don't attract because they are similar.
When he lay down with Makeda, Solomon sang.
For instance, how is the wise old King Solomon from the Bible, who inspired this Cassandra Wilson song, like this guy? Yes, Van Halen's David Lee Roth, whose hair inspired a generation of sprays, gels, and mullets. How are they alike? Well, quite a lot, if you can dare to think like a freak. Stephen Dubner, help me out here.
Hey, John.
Solomon, David
Lee
Roth.
Best radio introduction I've ever heard.
Hey, and that's a compliment coming from you. You got a podcast. Now you're a radio
that's
guy.
That's true. Thanks. Yeah. So we used King Solomon and David Lee Roth as the examples of guys who used a little bit of game theory in this case. When you have a big group of people and you're trying to separate them into A and B, or maybe good and bad, that's very often the guilty and the innocent. Sometimes you have to trick them, because guilty people tend to not run up to you and say, hey, I'm the one who did it. So King Solomon, his most famous story that proves his wisdom in the Bible, one baby, two women claiming to be the mother. He said, eh, no problem. Give me a sword. I'll cut it in half. Give you each. The one who objected, he decided, was the real mother. Now, you could argue, there's a lot of ways to argue with that, but that's an example from history. David Lee Roth's story has to do with the famous brown M&Ms that were not allowed backstage.
It's such a great story.
It is. And I should say, this is a story that's been around for a while. We didn't come up. We're not the first people to talk about the story.
The idea that they demanded that certain M&M colors be out of the bowl in their dressing room.
Sure.
Oh, gosh, these rock and rollers. But there was a deeper meaning.
Right.
Here.
It's taken as a symbol of just prima donna excess.
Right.
But in fact, the intent, if you believe David Lee Roth, who's talked about this for years, it's that he could go in and he'd see, and if the bowl in fact did contain the M&Ms that they said should not be there, the brown ones in this case, then they would know that the promoter had not read the rider or the contract rider carefully, and therefore there might be more serious problems with the setup of the electrical equipment, the lighting, the audio equipment, and so on. So it was a way to kind of separate, again, the ones who did their job from those who didn't.
And part of this is trying to investigate and reduce a group of people to the people that you're interested in.
Yeah.
Without having a lot of false positives. For instance, you know, we just had a conversation on the program about NYPD looking at Muslims in prison and trying to get them to be informants for terrorism. I suspect you would describe that, based on what you did in your second book, as a pretty crude algorithm.
Yeah,
false
positives can often be, you know, a false negative. You know, think about it in the medical sphere. False negative is, I go to the doctor feeling poorly and they say, don't worry about it, it's fine, and then, you know, I die. That's the false negative. We fear, and rightly so. But false positives, even in medicine, are very, very troubling. They clog up the system in all kinds of ways, produce all kinds of extra treatment and cost and so on. So, yeah, we did in our second book, Super Freakonomics, we wrote about an algorithm that we helped a British bank create to try to catch terrorists based on nothing more than retail banking data. And in that version of the story that we told in Super Freakonomics, we described the different markers that would indicate that someone looking at their banking data may be involved in terrorists or may know other terrorists.
Big initial deposit, no subsequent deposit, a slow drawdown, no obvious paychecks, those
Correct.
Kinds of things.
On and on. Many markers. And because most terrorists in the UK these days happen to be young, male, and Muslim, those did become markers as well, including, you know, not a lot of withdrawals from the ATM when services were going on. But there was one other marker that we put in the book, which was life insurance.
This is your brown M&Ms.
This was our – it's exactly right. This was our brown M&M. We said if you're someone who's planning to conduct a terrorist act at some point, the data shows that you don't buy life insurance, even though you may have a wife and two young kids. Why? Because it very well may not pay out in the the case of a terrorist activity.
So you go over on your book tour, get tons of attention, and a lot of questioners say, what are you telling the terrorists what to do? You're giving them information.
That's exactly right. Good accent, but they were angrier than that.
Accent.
They said, what the hell are you doing working for years to come up with a way to catch these guys and then giving them the secret? In other words, we wrote in the book, so if you're a terrorist and you want to avoid detection from our algorithm, what you should do is go to your bank and buy some life insurance.
And that's the marker.
That's the marker. So then our algorithm was already nicely in place at the bank watching. Now, who goes and to their bank of all places and buys life insurance? Because very few people buy insurance from their bank anyway. But who goes and buys it shortly thereafter and who also has all the other markers that seem to indicate terrorist activity? Well, thank you very much. They separated themselves nicely. It's a trick we call, in Think Like a Freak, we call this trick, teach your garden to weed itself.
Now, you don't have any information that anyone was caught or spotted buying insurance or anything like that, but it's more of a thought exercise.
Well, we, you know, the British authorities were very eager to have our lists of numbers. We weren't even given names, numbers. So we have no idea. It was very James Bondy, the whole thing, turning over these lists, but we have no idea what actually became of that.
One thing before we go, you know, just an indication of, I mean, there's so much to read about in here, and it's fascinating. One of the things you talk about here has actually been updated by events. If you type in Nigerian to Google, this whole kidnapping thing comes up. It's not the Nigerian scam that you talk about. So the sort of brand identity of Nigerians being associated with these internet scams that are all about false positives, finding the most gullible people. That's a really fascinating story.
That's true. The idea is that why on earth, if Nigerian scammers are known to be scammers, or if the Nigerian scam is known to be a scam, you know, dear sir, I am a beloved widow.
I got $40 million. Just send me $10,000.
Exactly right.
You can get the $40
million. Then why, if it's so well known, do they do it? And a very inventive researcher at Microsoft Research, a fellow named Cormac Hurley, who's mostly engaged in computer security and the way that new technology can be used by bad guys, said, wait a minute, why do they do that? Either they can be successful or stupid, but it's hard to imagine that they're both. And so he worked this problem through, and it turns out that from his mind, at least, and something that we agree with, it turns out that one of the best ways to screen for the right people to fall into your scam are to write these ridiculous emails that say you're from Nigeria, because who are you trying to seduce? Who are you trying to separate? The most gullible
people
out there.
The dumb ones. You want the dumb ones.
I wouldn't call them dumb quite, but
the victims, the vulnerable,
people who
gullible.
Anyone who doesn't fall off their chair laughing at the sight of a Nigerian email scam email is the kind of person you want to develop into. And there's a case where false positives will hurt you if you're the scammer. You don't want to get a million replies.
Such people should buy this book, Think Like a Freak. Stephen Dubner, co-author of Think Like a Freak, host of the Freakonomics podcast on Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. Always great to talk to you.
Thanks so much, John. You too. My pleasure.
So that book, Think Like a Freak, is a perfect book to nominate you to take part in our book club series, which we inaugurated last week. If you'd like to nominate your book club to take part in our series, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. We'll be discussing our first book next month. If you want to read along, the book is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. It comes out in bookstores tomorrow. And our first book club joining us to discuss To Rise Again is based in Portland, Oregon. Nominate your club. We'll tell you how at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.